Hey, welcome to season two of The Protectors. As usual, I have to give the quick kudos out that I keep having such amazing guests. Today's a very special guest, Christina Meredith. A book out, Cinder Girl, and the thing about her is she has accomplished so much in her life, and now she's, you know, just continues to do it. I really want you to hear her story. If you haven't heard of her before, you're going to hear of her now. So let's, without further ado. What's going on, Christina?
Hey, Jason. Thanks for
I see you have some company there. This sounds like one of my podcasts. This is definitely one of my podcasts. I'm
Potus. He's just the sweetest little bird dog ever.
Aw, how old is he?
He's 4 months.
Oh, my gosh. He's like a pup.
I know, but these paws. Can we just talk about these paws? Can you see it?
Yes.
They're ginormous.
Oh, my gosh. I have a Tree and Walker Coonhound, and she like it seems like every time I have a podcast, she's always like hounding in the background. Oh, so it's perfect though. This is reality. This is life.
Life. That's right. It's life.
Exactly. Hey, thanks for coming on. I'm trying to figure out where I found out about you. I heard your story, and I was like, "Oh, this is great." Your background's incredible. Let's get you on a show. So let's hear about you. Let's get the 30,000 foot overview of your childhood, which I don't even think you can, because that's what your book is about. You were the first guest I'm going to say, I want to hear about it. I want to know kind of what happened and how you ended up where you did in the foster care system.
So basically, I grew up in an Italian Catholic family. My mother and father married for 15 years, had eight of us. And then my mother had an affair with the lawyer for the sheriff's department and locked my father away, had two more children with her now ex-husband. And, you know, we got put in care legally when I was 16, but DCF started coming around when I was nine. But that's 1996 when I was nine. That's when my father got locked up for trumped up charges of spousal abuse because my mother was now with this very, you know, influential man. And the abuse just got worse and worse and worse. And I mean, I started being raped at nine by my mother's brother, and they took me to school for 2 years. I didn't know how to read until I was in high school. Never finished sixth grade, never went to seventh grade, never went to eighth grade. The fact that I wrote a book is Jesus. It's a miracle. But yeah, so I mean, abuse was just really bad for a long time. And like I said, DCF started coming around when I was nine. And they officially didn't take us away until I was 16. And that's just, you know, it's an injustice to children all the time. This happens all the time. Kids get weaved in and out of the system. And, you know, unification is the end all be all. And sometimes that's a beautiful thing to bring a family back to wholeness. But sometimes it's an absolute disaster. And children should be taken from those parents and be given to other parents who actually love them. And so in my case, ward of the state at 16, my mother severed parental rights over me. She didn't want me, literally told the judge she didn't want me. I read the court paper. My case file's like this. It's ridiculous. And then 18, senior in high school, first semester of my senior year, you know, couch surfing.
Yeah.
Aged out, bought a car the day after I graduated high school, moved into my car. Her name was Sunny, bright yellow like a school bus, two-door Chevy Cavalier. Lived in her for over a year. Wrote my 20-year plan. I'm in year 12 of my 20-year plan. It's going swimmingly.
You know, that's the thing is, you know, you watch on TV and all this, and they always bring up how messed up the foster care system is and how it needs so much help. And it continues to be that way.
Yeah.
You know, this is like our whole lives. I mean, I'm damn near 50 years old, two years away. And, it has always been a messed up situation, and let's throw money at the right people to do the right thing to fix it for once and all. I mean, it's got to be fixed. We're talking, look at your, I just imagine you and anybody like you just trying to live through that circumstance after being abused and your mental health. And that's one thing is your mental health was getting damaged.
Oh yeah. I mean, the mental abuse and psychological abuse was, and I talk about this in my book, I would prefer to be beaten than to have my mental and emotional abuse happen to me, because that took me decades of trauma therapy to overcome. You know, I mean, there's something that happens into our, as human beings, the way that we're wired, and a bruise can only last for so long, but psychological damage lasts until you deal with your junk. And so people are always wondering why they're having midlife crisis. And I'm always like, well, it's because you never dealt with your junk. It's trauma coming out of your body because you physically can't contain it anymore. And so I'm a big proponent for mandatory trauma therapy for all foster youth, and really for everybody. Because at some point we've experienced hardship or loss or trauma that's hard for us to manage and cope with. And we just find other ways. And you can stuff it away for a long time until it physically starts manifesting in your body and in your relationships and in your temper and in your temperament and in your ability to deal with crisis, other crises that come up. And so, yeah, mental health has been a huge platform of mine, PTSD healing, and, you know, really bringing back people to a place of wholeness, which is possible. It takes effort and takes work, and it takes whole healthy relationships to come back out of that dark side of abuse and trauma and PTSD. So there's this, it's kind of really up to people to decide, especially as adults, young adults who come out of the world that I come out of, do they want to perpetuate the cycle of abuse and poverty that they grew up in, or do they want to break the cycle and have healthy, whole relationships and have a family and give back to their communities? And that's really on an individual basis to take responsibility for your junk. And, you know, one of my biggest screamalls is death to self-pity. I'm not a victim. I grew up hard, and the system that I serve today failed me as a child. This is why I serve them. This is why I work for advocacy in foster care and do all the things that I do with my foundation, is to make it better. But I'm not a victim because of what I endured, and it strengthens me. It gives me chiseling to continue to lead in this area. And so if we can change our mindset for all things, not even just if you were in foster care, but any type of hardship or loss or trauma you've endured, if you can reshape it into your brain to use it as a chiseling tool for a better future or for a better tomorrow or for betterment in yourself, then you can really tap into some beautiful things. And you can really go the distance and make real change in yourself and in your community. It's all about not being a victim. Like, just because you were in foster care, yeah, you dealt a bad hand. Freaking blows. Trust me, I know, but you can overcome it. You've got to change the mentality, and that's when we can bring wholeness with the whole self and healthy relationships.
And that's what I like is you have a little video on your website, and part of it was saying, you know, you can be whole again. Yeah. It might take some time. And like you said, you can't do it on your own. And I wish people didn't think they could just sit back and, you know, they bury themselves within their memories or within their lives thinking that, okay, I could fix myself if I just find the one key memory that I could deal with. But you can't fix yourself. You need help. No,
you definitely need help. The way that we're wired is for community, is for relationship. And once you accept that and realize that you're not an island, then you can really start to grow and heal as a person. Do you need to be wise about who you're? I have a small circle of trust. I call it the nest. There's only so many birds that can fit in the nest. You tracking? So it's like, you've got to be very careful about who you allow in your circle. And those people need to be loving and safe and authentic. And when you find those people, you know, because they're going to call you out on your nonsense, but they're also going to love you in the process. It's a loving relationship that offers a safe space for you to be authentic and real and chisels out of you, you know, more greatness. And so that's why whole healthy relationships is the key to ending the cycle of poverty and abuse in our foster care system, because these kids don't have families. They have no stability. But once we offer them stability and wholeness with relationships, then they have support. They have that safety net, like most normal families, the nuclear family, the ideal, right? You know, and so that's what I work so hard for, is to ensure that children all across our nation, especially our orphans and our kids in care, that they have that stability, that they have that safety net that their peers have. And because they can be successful as their peers, they just need the opportunity and the stability and the love and the support, because we're sure shit more resilient than most people. That's for sure.
I like that. I like that concept of the nest. You know, that's a really good one. How many people can you fit in a nest? And when you said that, I thought about it. And I'm like, well, you know, I had probably about five or six people that I could really just reach out to right now and tell them my deepest, darkest thoughts and my what's going on with me mentally. But you don't want it to be overexpanded to where you're just telling and doing it to everyone. You'd really need that circle of trust, definitely.
You do. You have to be very wise about who you expose your vulnerabilities to. It can only be in the nest. Those people that are going to support you and love you in healthy ways, in healthy boundaries. My junk is not made for the world to see, just my small circle. And so, yeah, I share that all the time with young people and with my peers and people that I talk to. You know, I think it's really important to have that nest, you know, because it's true. It's just true. You have to have it.
It's good to talk about it and it's good to share. And I like how you're coming and doing interviews, like especially on The Protectors and other places. But one thing is writing. Writing is such, it's almost like therapy to me.
Oh,
I love writing. I love telling stories. Let's get into the book. And like you said, you didn't grow up with the best educational experience, but you did overcome and adapt. And now you have like a full-fledged, like bona fide published book with a publisher. It's incredible. How did that whole process? Awesome. Let's see it. Let's see the book.
This is Cinder Girl.
It looks great. I'm actually going to order that today.
Yeah. HarperCollins is my publisher. They've been excellent. And I'm just really blessed. But essentially, I decided at a very young age that I did not want to be like my mother. I did not want to be mean and hateful. I did not want to see people around me, my siblings. I saw them get beat all the time and the bruises and the scars and the blood and all the things. I didn't want that. I wanted normal. I wanted a family. I wanted love. I wanted security. I wanted safety. And I have literally planned my entire life around my future family that has yet to be yet. Everything that I have done in the last 15 years has been for my future husband and children to provide that type of environment, that the way that God intended it to be. And so early on, I just decided I didn't want to be anything like my family, and I worked towards that. And so even though in school I couldn't read and I was made fun of, and, you know, I came to school with holy clothes and I was that, you know, poor, awkward girl. But, you know, over years and time, God brought me through a lot of things and feeling. And I think a big step for me was when I competed in Miss California in 2013, totally out of my comfort zone. I did 4 years of ROTC all through high school. I always wanted to be an officer in the military. When I got rejected from the ROTC scholarships and all the academies, I was like, well, I guess the only thing I'm good at, I'm not allowed to do. So I just ended up bartending for like a decade. I was a bar manager for a long time. And then in 2013, a pageant recruiter came up to me at Whole Foods. And I was like, yo, you've got the wrong girl. One, I'm from the South. Two, I've been shooting. I was captain on the rifle team. I've spit like the boys. Like, I'm a tomboy. I never went to prom. Like, I worked a double at the Firehouse Subs, the, you know, prom day. So it's just, so when that guy approached me, I was like, nah, this is crazy. But then I looked it up online, and when I got home, and I was like, holy crap, this could be a real opportunity for a girl like me.
Definitely, definitely.
And I decided that day that I was going to compete in the Miss California pageant. And my boyfriend at the time, which is so funny, I told him, and he goes, you can't do that. You'll never win. I broke up with him the next day, and I put my hat in for to be Miss Ventura. And I won. And then I went to state, and I won that. And then I went to nationals. And just the experience, I think, that just competing on that level and putting myself out there in that way really brought a lot of healing for me in a lot of areas, and chiseled out of me some courage that I didn't think I had, because pageantry is a sport. I don't think people realize that.
No, it is.
Thousands of dollars that I had to raise to just compete was absurd. And the training and the elegance. And I mean, it's a whole thing. It is a sport. And that really gave me the platform to launch my foundation and do all the things that I wanted to do and finish my book. Cause I started writing my book when I was homeless. I knew that's what I wanted to do. It was all the things I'm doing now. I knew I wanted to do when I was homeless at 18 and 19.
Well, you know, one thing about the pageant too, is like being in a foster care, I can only imagine your self-esteem being pushed, you know, kind of around here and there, boom, boom, boom. Then all of a sudden you're on a pageant stage. Like, not, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, we're talking like a decade plus later. it's got to be good for your self-esteem and for yourself. I'm not going to say worth, but just kind of, you know, hey, you know what? Here I am.
Yeah.
I did it. I'm succeeding. Hey, you know, by the way, service academies, maybe if I did get accepted, things would have went a different way. Maybe I wouldn't have a foundation. You know, you're right where you're supposed to be. And part of that, and 99.9 or not even 100%, is probably due to your faith, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I never waver in my commitment to the Lord. Never have. I read my Bible the entire time I was homeless. And honestly, the pageant for me was less about the crown and the title and more about the authenticity in hearing my name. Because for years, my mother wouldn't call me by my name, and she forced my siblings to call me other names. And so my name was stupid or dumb or slut or demon. And so for years and years and years, I never heard my name. And then when I heard my name over those loudspeakers, healing came.
Mm-hmm.
My name was spoken. I was Christina Meredith, my name. And so for me, that was the whole, like, just grieving of healing coming at that moment. It was just this beautiful tearing apart and tearing off the sackcloth and ashes and moving forward as this beautiful butterfly.
I like it. You know, and faith is so important. And that's one thing about my show is I'll talk about faith all day long. The only thing I steer away from is politics. And we've already talked about that before the show.
Yeah,
it's not worth it going into it because
nope.
I'm not going to alienate some part of the audience. But when it comes to faith, hey, you know what? I believe in God. I believe in a higher being. And I believe that it is just such an important thing to have that. I don't care what your religion is or whatever, but you need to believe in something.
Oh, yeah. The Lord has his ways of speaking to us all on our level. He's very faithful. Mm-hmm. To that. And so for me, God has always been there and he's never failed me, which is why I've dedicated my life to be a servant leader like he is.
Well, you're not only dedicating your life to that. Now you're actually in the military.
I've been bona fide. You are serving. I started out as a 74 Delta Seaburn chemical guy. I know. Like the highest of speeds, people always like to shit on Seaburns, but it's fine. We're worthy now. But now that COVID,
now you're great. my gosh!
I just went over to the dark side 2 weeks ago. I was commissioned second lieutenant, and I'm a signal intelligence officer and serving here in Austin. And you know, I love the Army. The Army has been a big part of my life for a really long. The military has been a big part of my life since I was 14 years old, and so I had this dream from 14. Until my senior year to become an officer, that route didn't work and God brought me another way. And so I served for 4 years as an enlisted soldier and now I'm about to pay my dues on the dark side and I'm very excited.
It's fun, I tell you. Well, I shouldn't say, I don't know if fun's the word, but you know, there are part of it that's fun because I was enlisted for 93 to 99. And then from 99 to 2006, I was in the reserves in IRR and I got recalled to the tour in Iraq in 05, 06,
nice.
Part of that Kuwait, then up in Iraq. But yeah, I, you know, I miss it sometimes. I resigned my commission in 06. But yeah, I love the Army and if I didn't have the Army, there's no way I would be where I'm at right now. No way.
This is how, so for me, I've got a lot of long-term plans, right? And so what the Army has done for me in my life, not only chisels out of me a type of grittiness and character and integrity and duty and honor and obligation, all those things, but it grows me on a personal level to dig deeper into uncomfortableness. And I think the training that they put us through for all the schools and deployments and all the different things that we do, it really does chisel out a certain type of leadership that can't be found anywhere else because of all of the hard situations that we have to deal with on a daily basis and all of the hard places that we continually have to be in. And so for me, the Army has just been this amazing opportunity to be a better person. And I just love it. I love everything about it.
I like the, you know, it's this suck. You embracing the suck together, it builds better teams. It does. I don't care what anybody says. If you're not, you know, if it's not raining, you're not training. If they always say that, because when it's raining and you're training together and you're all sitting around going, damn, I'm pretty miserable right now.
Yeah, you freaking suck ass. But guess what? Yeah. Your battle buddies are right there sucking ass.
Yeah. And you could always go back and tell those stories. Like two decades later, you could be talking shit and saying this, the same stories. But you remember that time it was raining and we were wet and our sleeping bags were wet and we were freezing and blah, blah, blah every time.
Yeah. There's like seven operations that we did for hurricanes. Cause I was stationed in Jacksonville before I was stationed here in Austin. Yeah. You know, Operation Irma. I have a million stories like that. Cause we 24 hour op, I was in the top 24 hour ops, you know, and it's being no electricity. It's just, I mean, think about it. It's 21 days of just no electricity working in the talk with the same 12 people.
I know. When I, I think I mentioned in my book, I don't even remember. I don't talk about it too much because it was just part of the training. But when I got recalled, I was recalled for 18 months. And the first few months I was at Benning. And the second three or four months I was in Camp Shelby, Mississippi in the summer of 2005. Right in time for Hurricane Katrina. Yeah. And we got nuked. It was like the camp looked like the end of Predator after the hurricane. Yeah. And I think it was like 30 something days without power. And we were just eating. It was interesting times back then. Very interesting.
Yeah. But that's what comes back to, you know, that's why I love our true 1%, our military servicemen and women. There's something unique about us that we pile into the uncomfortable. We're like, the more uncomfortable, fuck yeah, let's do this. Mm-hmm. Like, into it. Let's just tackle this. And I think that's why I'm so drawn to continue my military career and continue to serve and be around people like us, because life is hard. Life is hard. Mm-hmm. The more we accept the suffering and the more we embrace it, the easier it becomes.
Yeah.
And the deafening blows aren't deafening blows. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And you know, the service continues and you're doing the same thing. You're continuing your service, not only while you're still serving, but with a nonprofit. Let's talk about that. And really let's talk about how we could support it.
Yeah. So the Christina Merritt Foundation, I launched that in 2013 after I won Miss California. And I just got this in last year, 2019, it became a 501c3. So we're official, praise God. And basically I advocate for policy reform on the state and local, state and federal levels for all foster care reform, specifically mandated trauma therapy and mandated after school activities. Right now, it's a little bit more complicated because of COVID. So I'm pushing for, you know, upping the Chafee Fund to $500 million and having specific language in there for transitioning age youth in the next COVID relief bill, because so many of our foster care youth in that age population have become homeless because of job loss. You know, everyone lost their jobs and food insecurity because they don't have the money to take care of themselves anymore because of, no, like we talked about earlier, no security net. They don't have that family to go back to. They don't have a mom and dad or grandparents or aunts and uncles that can be like, hey, I lost my job. Can you help me cover rent? Or these kids are literally losing their lives. I mean, ending up in sex trafficking and the opioid crisis and all these horrible places that the stats show are real. And so the advocacy now is more focused on relief for our foster care kids right now for the COVID. But we do a lot of work. And then the second portion of that is, we're building our first charter school right here in Austin. I'm so excited about that. And it's designed to propel foster youth to be successful as their peers. And so we will offer a prestigious education with the IB and AB, JROTC Army will be there. Really just giving them the equality and the opportunities as their peers with the charter school. So I'm excited about that.
You know, that's amazing. I'm really, really impressed by your background, about you, about how your career is going, and especially the nonprofit. I didn't know too much about the nonprofit. I didn't realize you were going to do the charter school, and the kids need it. You brought up one point about the abuse that the kids in the foster care system go. I know I typically stay positive with the show, but this is something that we need to keep an eye on.
It's a national crisis.
It is. I mean, trafficking is just... between the trafficking, between the sexual abuse, between the kids getting used just to, you know, because they're a paycheck for the foster parent. It needs to be addressed, you know, and we're talking, and I'm, you know, we're not talking, you know, going to Congress and doing like a dog and pony show where nothing happens. There needs to be solid policy.
Yep.
Laws.
Yep. We're working on it. I promise, diligently every day working on policy reform and legislation that has special language just for our kids. Because here's what I believe, in out of uniform, it's my job to serve. But specifically, these kids, it's my American obligation to take care of our American children that don't have families. It is our duty. And I can't sleep at night knowing that there's 20,000 children aging out this year, and 2 out of 4 of them will become homeless like I did. I can't.
And then what happens to them, you know?
What happens to them? 31% of the girls end up pregnant. 81% of the boys end up in prison. And the rest of them end up in the opioid crisis, sex trafficking, and or dead. Yep. And that's just facts. So for me, I just can't, or I'm doing all the things I promised to really make change. And, you know, everyone needs to get on this. It's a community effort. I can't do it by myself. And thank God I'm not. There's hundreds of organizations that are nationally known around the country that are also advocating and fighting for our kids. But it needs to keep getting up to a national level, to where this is a national conversation and not just between, you know, people like us who are trying to make our communities better.
You know, I'm not going to discount that there are very great, incredible foster parents out there, but you know, we need to focus on the ones that aren't. And like you said, you know, I try to tell people, and you've seen evil before I did. As far as your age, but I didn't really see it until I got into law enforcement. And then trying to explain to how people are very, just, there are very sick, deranged, evil people out there that will take advantage of everything they can. Kids are a commodity to them. They are to be used, to be abused, and when they're done, they discard them either to death or opioid addictions or other addictions, are just used mentally, done. And we need this, that people need to get out of the bubble. And this isn't political. This is just saying, get out of the bubble that we're living in, this utopia where everybody has a moral compass, because not everybody does.
No, absolutely not. And it's our job, as we're the gatekeepers. So I believe men like us, it's our job to stand up for justice and stand up for injustice. And so I really believe that God is raising up an army of people just to protect and to preserve the innocence of our children, specifically our children in the system right now who don't have support. And so that's what I've dedicated my entire life to do.
Great. You know what? You got plenty of life left and you're going to do it. You're going to see positive steps. You're working with one of the best senators out there right now. He's helped me out. He's done so much. He's actually changed. When I came forward and did what I had to do, he actually had policy changed, signed off through law, and then signed off by the president. So it can happen. Before I start winding it down, because I don't want to keep you too long, the title Cinder Girl, where did that come from?
Okay. So Cinder Girl, thought of it when I was homeless living in my car. And at first my publisher was like, no, we're not going to name it that. And I was like, no, this is the name. It's been the name since I was 18. And I started writing my manuscript when I was 18 and homeless, because I knew this was one of the things that I've been called to do. And they fought me on it for 3 years. They fought me on it. And just before we went to print, they decided, you know what? You're right, Christina, we're going to go with your name and your title, and your face is going to be on the cover. And I was just like, oh, thank God, because Cinder Girl comes from cinder of ashes. If there was a real life Cinderella, it would be me. So it just fit naturally. And I really believe that, you know, the beauty of turning, what God does is he takes our ashes and he turns them into beauty. He really does that. He really does restore and redeem all things. And so I think Cinder Girl is just a play on words to really encompass all of that, you know, all of those themes, and just the redemption that comes with what God can do.
Oh, I love it. That is a perfect title. This has been a great interview. Is there anything you would like to add?
No, I just want to encourage people out there who are listening, who are struggling with any type of unhealed wounds or unhealed trauma, if you've been experiencing some hardships in your life, especially right now with COVID, I know it's the isolation is very difficult on our mental health. I just want to encourage you to reach out to your small circle, to reach out to your nest. The nest is safe, and you can do all the things in there with those people and really tap into your relationships, because that's where you're going to bring healing and wholeness. That's where you can best be served, so you can be a better service to others. And so I just want to encourage people to really work on themselves so they can do all the things God has called them to do.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Christina. And we'll have you on the show again, definitely.
Oh, sure. Next book's coming out soon.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.